Hi guys, what's up, and welcome to a new episode of Train Smart Move Well. I'm your host Philip Jacobs, and today I am honored to welcome Lassie Laxo as my guest. Lassie and my path crossed for the first time in England at St. Mary's University in London Twickenham, where we both studied in the MSc in Strength and Conditioning. Lassie is an experienced athlete and coach in the field of ice hockey, and it was a pleasure for me to have him on board for this podcast. In this episode, we discuss training philosophy, coaching principles, and Lassie also gives us insight into his daily responsibilities as head of S&C at Hockey Club Lugano. Without further ado, let's get this started. You ready to go?
Yeah.
Let's do this. Name?
Lassie Laxo.
Born in?
Finland.
Living in?
Switzerland.
Father of how many children?
Three.
Lassie, your favorite color is?
Blue.
Your hate exercise in the weight room?
Hate? Right away difficult. I don't like doing the hip thrust.
You don't like doing the hip thrust? Trust the thrust, man. What's your love exercise in the weight room?
Back squat.
Nice. Your last strength training was?
2 days ago.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had water and a green tea and a Greek yogurt with granola and fruit.
Dead away to have breakfast. Dear Lassie, welcome to Train Smart Move Well. It's a pleasure to have you here on board. And after having bravely answered this rather random collection of questions, maybe tell us in a few sentences, who are you? What are you doing, and what is happening in your life right now?
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Philip. Who am I? I'm a strength and conditioning coach, father of three kids, like I said, former ice hockey player myself. So I would say a whole life spent in sports. I'm a person interested in many things, I would say, also outside of sport. Just trying to make the best of this life, and at the moment trying to be a good husband, a good father, and a good coach at the same time. And so you had to repeat, what was the other questions you asked me here? Who am I?
So this is who you are. What are you doing, and what is happening in your life right now? That's part two and three. We can get to that right now.
Yeah. So what am I doing as a professional? My role is head of S&C for Hockey Club Lugano, which is an ice hockey club in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So really I'm responsible for the athletic preparation of our professional players and basically overviewing the pathway of the youth players that come up through the academy teams in Lugano. I would say professionally that kind of summarizes what I do right now.
Awesome. And we will dive into that a little later on. Very specifically, I have a bunch of questions about your overall philosophy as a coach, which can also be found on your website, which I will put in the show notes for everyone that's interested. But before we dive in there, you can also read on your website that you didn't start as head of S&C at Hockey Club Lugano. You already mentioned that you were a professional hockey athlete yourself before. But I also think I remember that when we met each other at St. Mary's University for our masters, you also told me that you had a couple of steps in between. So I would really like to maybe talk a little bit about your background and story as to how you started from an athlete and how you slowly developed to the position that you're holding at this moment.
Yeah,
so maybe let's dive in with you as an athlete. So whom were you playing for? How long was your career? How did it end? And how did you then found your way from an active athlete towards becoming a coach?
Yeah, so like I said, I was born in Finland. I grew up in Switzerland, and as a kid, I right away found love for ice hockey as a sport. I played a different sports, growing up, but ice hockey was always the main one. And I guess the main dream in life was just to play ice hockey professionally. And I was able to play ice hockey and live of it until I was 26 years old. But played mostly like in the second highest league in Switzerland, which was again enough to kind of live the dream, if you want to say. So, which was still doing what I wanted to, but maybe didn't reach the the highest level that I would have hoped or dreamed of. And then had a few injuries during during my career. Developed kind of an interest for physical training during those playing years. With another friend, we just started to attend personal training courses and fitness instructor, really mostly by interest rather than thinking ahead as far as a potential future career.
Were you having strength and conditioning service at that time in your career? Was there an SNC coach?
Yeah, it depends always in which teams I played for. There was something, you know, whether it was a full-time or it was just some type of help. But I mean, there was something we knew, obviously training was important and there was always some type of guidance. And then had a pretty big concussion when I was 25 years old. Was a few months of, I would say darkness also just because it was lots of time spent in a dark room. I think at the time I probably didn't get the guidance that athletes get nowadays with a concussion return to health protocols first. And but anyway, I was lucky that it kind of still turned to the better side for me, and I was able to play one more year. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it a lot, and then I kind of felt like maybe this is the moment now where it's time to do something else. And then I was offered a chance by Lugano, a team that I had played for when I was 18, 19 years old, to come back as an assistant coach. They had the U17 assistant coach was leaving, and they mm-hmm. asked me if I wanted to take the position, knowing that my wife is from Lugano. At the time we were not married, but obviously looking at living together. And yeah, that was the decision. It was early in the preseason. I was still looking for potentially having a tryout contract somewhere. And then I remember they asked me, like, you know, I said, well, maybe I'm interested, but when should I answer? I said, right now.
So they had you on the phone?
Yeah, I was on the phone. So I said, can I have at least one night to think about it? And yeah, sure. But then tomorrow morning, we need to know. And then,
okay.
Obviously, being already preseason, I wasn't finding the contract I was hoping for. The idea of just keep playing in the B National League wasn't something I was reconsidering, or didn't find that was going to bring me anything in my life at that point anymore. Mm-hmm. So I guess next morning it was clear for me, and I accepted, and I started being an assistant coach for the U17 team, and then developed on the side a personal training business here in Lugano, which I did for the first 3 years that I was here. And then from 3 years assistant coach in with the U17, I moved up as assistant coach to the U20 team, and then started to take also some SNC coach responsibilities there. And then from there grew up. I had a mentor who was working with a professional team here, kind of took me under his wing and then helped me grow into the role. And then after a couple of years, I moved up to the professional team here. And I've been here, I guess, in this team since 2013, and as a head of SNC for the whole club since 2014.
Wow, okay. So reaching the 10-year anniversary soon.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great stuff. Thank you for sharing. So you are in your mid-20s, having just recovered from a rather tough hit with the concussion that you mentioned, the dark time, getting back in shape, playing for another year. So technically, I don't know much about hockey, but I would assume that usually playing age can go all the way until 30, mid-30s maybe even. So technically, you still had a couple of years ahead of you, but then all of a sudden you get this opportunity, which kind of also suits location-wise with your wife living there. And then you just took it and transitioned from athlete to becoming a coach. Yeah,
exactly. I don't think it was ever in my plans really to be a coach later. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I had so clear plans of what life will be after sports, which I think is the case often for many athletes. You're living in the moment and you invest the whole of yourself in what you're doing. I knew there was going to be something after. In that moment, I just felt that it was, you know, the right train that was there for me. And sometimes you have to jump on the train because you never know when when you're gonna have the next train for you and take a chance. And in that moment, it just felt like, yeah, it's probably the time to move on. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an easy decision. Today, I'm happy I took that decision, because I wouldn't be here in my life, obviously, had I chosen a different road in that moment. And I'm happy to have done that. But then obviously we met through our studies in St. Mary's, and this is something that I didn't do university studies while I was playing, or I did something distance learning, but the first couple of years there was kind of a promise to my mom, you know. I said, yeah, you know, you play I'll play, but I keep studying at that time. And it just wasn't, I wasn't getting anything out of it, so it kind of stayed there. But the more I was going forward with my career, the more I was feeling like, I'm missing something. I'd like to learn more. There's so many quality programs around that this is really something I'd like to look at. But at the same time, I'm working a full-time job, and I'm really enjoying my position, and I'm not leaving everything. And then I have kids. I'm not going to leave everything to go study a bachelor's degree somewhere, you know, full-time.
Yeah.
And this basically, that's when I found St. Mary's, the master's degree of St. Mary's, distance learning, that had the non-degree entrance pathway with you know, if you had a certain level of experience. And so those things, I guess, happen for me. I found the right things at the right moment, and I probably did this the not conventional way, or the typical way that people first study and then enter maybe intern positions and grow up in their career. But yeah, I'm glad it went this way for me, and couldn't be more grateful at the moment.
Yeah, that's awesome. I guess you didn't have the typical, I don't know, call it an academic pathway, but more the athletic one, because I mean, you had already skin in the game and a foot in because of your experience and time as an athlete, and therefore you could already start practicing the coaching perspective also. Yeah. Before we dive into your training philosophy, I just want to get back quickly on that moment when you said you joined the under 17 as an assistant coach, but you also started growing the personal training business on the side. And I can really resonate with this one, because this is basically where I am at right now. Like the basketball team that I deliver strength and conditioning service for, I'm not doing that as a full-time position. And my main business also in terms of income, but also working hours, is personal training. On one hand, I really enjoy it. It's awesome to have this, high level performance oriented setting where it's really about putting everything together, everybody working towards that one goal of winning games and having a good season, versus the other one where I'm working more with the general population, and it's about finding solutions for individuals to somehow keep training and keep movement in their life, or bringing it back to them because they lost it and, you know, want to change that. So I was going to ask you, how was that for you when you were having both things simultaneously? Did you feel sometimes torn apart like I used to, or was it just, you know, I'm doing the PT in order to get everything in later in hockey? Like how did you perceive that that chapter in your life?
I thought it was very enjoyable time in my life, as far as because you're building something, and when you're learning and building, I think there's some excitement and that goes into that. And the hockey part was obviously you go from playing with other adults to now you're coaching 15, 16 year old kids. So there was the whole part of adjusting this role and just basically learning. You have the experience, but now it's how can I help the team and help these kids as well as possible. Obviously, there was a professional full-time head coach with the team at the time, and I was learning from him a lot also. So that was, but and then on the other side, it was personal training, which was my business and my personal challenge that moment, if you want, which I really enjoyed. There's people that I became friends, and I still maybe might meet or talk to today. many years later, and I thought that was actually very complimentary. You know, through personal training, you learn a lot about the connection with people. You learn to yes. coach differently. If you want to consider now the professional skills, and it was in that way was very, very useful. I think quite soon in that time, then it still became clear in my head that the path I was seeing for myself was more in sports if the opportunity would come up, which then it came up, and that's when I switched back to being full time in sports, which is really the world that I probably know the best.
Mm.
But I really enjoyed. It became very busy. Handling both businesses at the same time, and that's what happens when you're building things. You're usually being busy is a good sign also, right?
Yes, it's true. Let's talk about your philosophy. On your website, there's a very long sentence. I'm just going to read the whole thing out, but then I have a couple of questions about certain bullet points that would interest me. You're saying your philosophy is to help athletes build help athletes in an ethical manner reach the best possible results in their sports by providing appropriate tools for their athletic development. And then it goes on, but let's stick with that first part of the sentence. Help athletes in an ethical manner reach the best possible results. How do you define ethical manner in that sense?
I think it can mean it can have different meanings depending the point of view you're taking with that. It can be just as far as substances used by athletes, methods you're talking about with your athletes. So obviously being in a business where this is the profession of these people, you want to make sure you're following the rules of the organizations that we compete in. And then it's the whole ethical part of being honest with them about there was someone turning the music in the room, so I was a bit distracted here. Just doing the right things and being open and transparent, that's really where I see the ethical part. Yep. I think we're in a business where people tend to push things to limit because they try to define themselves as something by doing something different than other people, and they wanna how do you say define themselves by either training methods or something they do, and that tends to go then sometimes a bit too far as what we're trying to say or pretend that we get from these methods or whatever people do. So I think it's just about being honest, using evidence-based best practice, just staying within the rules and also thinking about the human part and the future of the athlete also, you know, like you're doing healthy things with them.
Yeah, the human part and the athlete or long-term thinking part is something I find interesting that you mention it. And maybe the example would serve well to say whether there's a certain training method or an intervention that we know might be improving their, I don't know, vertical jump or their acceleration even to a further extent, but it is also risky in terms of the impact that you place on them via certain training methods. And then I would guess you would consider ethical to either say, yes, okay, this is something that we can do and we can allow ourselves to do right now because it's, I don't know, preseason, or we should rather not do because we risk the player to get injured because it's in the middle of the season and we're having games every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, that's an example, obviously.
We discussed ethical manner. Now you're talking about reach the best possible results in their sports by providing appropriate tools for their athletic development with athlete-centered and outcome-focused approach. So how do you choose or define whether something is appropriate? What is athlete-centered and what is outcome-focused approach for you?
Maybe I'll start with the outcome focused.
Yeah.
So for this means that I'm not in love with a particular method. For me, it's just what will get the results. I'm not the weightlifting coach. I'm not, you know, whatever, sprint coach. I'm just making sure we get the result we want with the athletes. And that's where the athlete-centered focus is really, obviously the athletes and the athlete and the athlete's development is at the center of this. It will be driven by the game in our case. Like ice hockey has requirements that we mm-hmm. need to make sure the athlete can achieve to be able to play at a certain level. But obviously then I'm working with the athlete and the development of this athlete needs to be the priority, not a given number or an exercise. And what's appropriate for this athlete now is considering everything else they do for the sport, obviously, right? Like these guys have demands all year round, on the ice, off the ice. There's moments where the priority is a competition. There's moments where coaches want to have time for other things. There's moments where we can afford to have soreness, where we cannot afford to have soreness. So it's just considering everything that's in the needs of the athlete, appropriate. Like we spoke before, there's obviously the injury risk. You want to always keep it as low as possible, obviously. But there's also moments where you just need to push the intensity of training. If you do it well, you want to hope you always do it in a smart manner, and you obviously don't want to put your athlete at any risk. But a high chronic training load goes a long way as far as injury prevention. to reach a high chronic load training with intensity, well, it takes them time to build, and these guys are in such good shape and often so advanced in the training that you're pushing the machine really hard on them, and then it becomes a fine line of when are you going over, or are you training, what's training enough and then what's not training too much. Or so it's, yeah, finding this balance is definitely, I would say, a challenge, because I really believe in pushing the athletes. They can't take it too easy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, finding all these characteristics and then mixing it as far to find what the right program or what you think the better program will be for that athlete in that moment.
Yes, I understand. So trying to make an example out of this again, you're talking outcome focused. So as long as we get there, it doesn't matter with what method we're reaching that goal. So again, using this example of an athlete that you want to be able to jump higher, you don't really worry whether he does that with hang power cleans or whether it's loaded trap bar jumps or if it's just bodyweight plyometrics. Because in this athlete-centered approach, you let him maybe decide or choose what he feels like is best working for him, as long as he, in the end, is able to jump higher. Do I understand that correctly in this way?
I think the autonomy is something we'll talk after, and letting the athlete choose, but there's also guiding the athlete. Let's say you're looking for a specific physiological adaptation, and if different methods will give you these like, I'm not going to be against a method just because I don't like it or if it's not my go-to method, I like weightlifting. Some guys don't have the technical competency, or they have an injury history that doesn't allow them to do, or they just really don't like it or want to try it to get it. They're scared of maybe just having it won't feel good for them. You just find other ways, you find other ways of training that power, other exercises where you're going to target that rate of force development, or so it's finding ways about what the circumstances are with the athlete and the adaptations you're looking for. There's different ways of getting those neuromuscular adaptations. That's where I mean by that is that you can work your way around any training method, really. Can be a moving people on the leg press instead of on the back squat, and then just any type of example of how simple the modification might be, or just how much it might actually impact the whole program. But really, it's about getting the athletes to get better, and not about the method you're choosing.
Yes, thank you. And then the last part of that sentence is, while offering an education, aimed at providing athletes greater long-term autonomy and responsibility. And I guess we can also kind of use that as a nice bridge to talk about autonomy later on. You're saying you want to offer education. So that means you take it as your own responsibility as a coach to provide athletes with more knowledge, expertise, or a toolbox, so to speak, in the weight room that they can become a better practitioner in the gym themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, like we coach people, we don't coach programs.
So, and not machines, yeah.
And the machines. So by coaching people, it's just a relationship that you build with the person. And if you look at the long-term development, and long-term can be, you know, 2 years or 15 years. And I think long-term happens at any age. It should not be just thought of something with youth athletes. You need to have a communication, and you will need the athlete to understand what they do, why they do it, to start first for the buy-in. Mm-hmm. For them to have a full buy-in, the better they understand, typically, the more they will find interest and maybe drive and motivation for what they do. And then it's about, again, there's lots of moments where the athletes, the way the athletes perceive what they do, how they respond to training methods is sometimes just as important as what really happens, maybe physiologically. And for that, you need to have that communication, and they need to maybe understand a bit what's happening. And that's where, yeah, I think I like to make sure that their training grows while we train together.
Yeah.
And I think there's a moment where they won't be with you anymore, or you'll just be too busy with other people, or for whatever reason, they'll need to take decisions on their own. How I see it is that you're going to help them make those best possible decisions when that moment comes.
Yes, I really like that approach. And then you write a whole article about providing athletes autonomy in the weight room, which I looked into yesterday, and I find it quite interesting. One of the beginning lines in your introduction is, let's see where I can find it. Autonomy is often quickly removed when results do not go according to plan, although saying according to hopes or illusions would sometimes be more accurate. Playing devil's advocate here, Lassie, what do you mean with that?
I think talking with coaches around, like usually autonomy is seen as something that people need to deserve, mm-hmm.
To build towards it.
Yeah, that it should not be granted, you know, mm-hmm. and if you take autonomy as a way of that you're actually losing control and you have less command, or command is not the right word, but losing control, and you're that it's not the best way of doing things, then obviously when things get tighter, you will feel like, okay, now we take away that freedom, you know, like now we do exactly what I say, which, you know, I in high pressure situations, I understand that this can be the reflex response by people and coaches. I mean, we're in professional sports, you're paid for to provide results. I think the difference here in the thought process comes from how you value the impact of autonomy. I don't see it as something being less good as a very controlled program. Saying that, though, it doesn't mean I give freedom everywhere at all. Obviously, like I think you can talk to some players I've coached, and they will feel like I guide a lot, mm-hmm. very precisely what we do. So I think there's a moment and there's a way of having autonomy in programs that will depend always on the circumstance, the context, the people you're working with. So it's I wouldn't put there at all a black or white rule, you know, as far as this is how we have to do it.
Yeah.
I just believe in being proactive. I believe in building the best possible processes from the start, not as a reaction to now things are going bad. And if I believe from the start that building autonomy a certain way is part of that best practice solution, then I should make it in a way that I don't need to remove it because now things are going bad. For example, the results level, let's say, for example, in ice hockey, like on the ice, you're losing games. Mm. It doesn't mean that the whole process is wrong. And yep. It doesn't mean you should remove some of the things that you actually believe provide value to the whole program. Yeah.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, you said, when I give autonomy to my athlete, that doesn't automatically mean that I'm losing control in a way. But I find it interesting because I would assume, and I think maybe also in the beginning for me, that was kind of the trap that I fell into. I thought like, oh, okay, but then I'm giving it away from my hands and let them do whatever they want. Obviously, this is not the case. So I was wondering, do you think it could also sometimes be either when coaches decide, no, I'm not going to do that, partly insecurity or even a too big of an ego because they want to stay in control and not give something away?
Yeah, I think, I've obviously been in sports for so long, so I've seen a lot of things, and I understand the mechanism, and I understand and respect also the responsibility that we have, when you have and take full responsibility for something, it's always easier. It feels easier when you feel you dictate everything that you're in charge of. Mm. I think it's very natural to say, okay, I believe I'm good in this. I'm going to control every single thing here. And at least I can say we eat my way, for example. And I think I can understand that people will think that way. I just believe that you can get better results in some of the ways that it's easy to justify the work you've done when you can show every single thing. And it's always easier to say we worked harder and we worked more than to say we worked a bit less today or today this session should not be that hard. Or again, it's easier to say I had full control of the thing than to say, yeah, I gave some freedom and this was what we came up with. So I think this it comes from the high pressure environment of these jobs, I think.
Yeah. But you're also saying that the regulation of autonomy in general can be implemented at different degrees, and it should be distinguished from complete independence, aka do whatever the hell you want. So how do you go about, or how do you decide who is when ready for autonomy? Because I would assume you would differentiate between a player A and a B and a C depending on how many years they have experience in the weight room and how well they are, I don't know, intrinsically motivated and so on and so forth. So how do you go about that?
Yeah, and I think at the start I used this chart that was, I had different categories of players as far as how much you get autonomy, what does that mean practically, what are your responsibilities in that phase to basically deserve the next step of autonomy. But really, because it's never black or white, you have so many factors that come into play in the relationship with the athlete and in the readiness to have autonomy. And that I didn't feel it was really appropriate to have these levels of autonomy or categorization. Mm-hmm. But then again, if you look at autonomy, giving freedom or choices for things that are not even task relevant will actually improve, for example, motor learning or buy-in. So I think you can give autonomy to even anybody. I just ask, like, who do you want to be lifting with today? Like, what are the groups, the two people you want to be lifting on, or on which platform you want to lift on? Well, we know that, motor learning can improve just by giving this type of decisions, they don't really impact your program that much.
Yeah.
Possibly they could also, like, there's moments where you want to be guiding the groups, especially maybe in junior teams where it can quickly become a mess if you have in certain contexts. But Yeah, I think that there's lots of ways to provide autonomy, and sometimes, you know, like in pro sports, we play 2 to 3 times per week. We have a gym session. You're gonna have injuries. You're gonna have lots of scenarios. You know, I have players come in. We need to do this in the next half an hour. I have, you know, this is happening, or I can't really lift here, or my knee is bothering me. Well, now the autonomy might be just that I don't just say, okay, do the leg press, or it might be, what do you think would be the best exercise you can do today? Or, you know, what do you think? It's at least going to give me the chance to hear what they think. We might go with that. We might find another. I might just justify that maybe something else is better for a certain reason. But usually, opening that communication, that choice will then just increase the buy-in by the players, and they feel that they're working for them, they're being listened, and this will then increase their motivation and buy-in. So, like you said, autonomy can be given at lots of different levels, and I think you just take a step back from that very directive authority type of leadership and coaching, and then just you know, coach and work with people.
Yeah, the drill sergeant stereotype that just shouts at you, do your sets of 10. Yeah, this typical answer to the question, what should I do, is also mentioned in your text. And then you say, your typical answer is, what do you think would be best for you? So you open up that dialogue, like you just mentioned, and let them know that they can be part of the decision-making process. And I've also started doing this maybe a year ago, both with athletes and also with clients in the personal training setting. But I at least feel like there's to a certain degree, when somebody's like maybe completely starting new. So let's say a personal training client who has never trained or moved before. I would feel that they have a limited ability to make a good decision in terms of this is what I actually really need to do. It doesn't mean that we can't have them let them be part in the decision making, but I would say for us as coaches in this scenario, it is a bit more important to give more guidance and maybe nudge people in certain directions as to more experienced people from the gen pop or even athletes. Can you agree with that? Do you have a different take on this? How do you see that? Also in your athletes.
Yeah, I see exactly what you say. And if we take, let's say, an under 15 player who is in the
Yeah.
weight room for the first year, the ability to take these decisions will be very limited, even just by the knowledge of the person. You know, one way to do if there's something that need to be changed, or if you want to provide autonomy, it could be just even you give choice A or B that you know are two good choices, and then it might be just a personal preference, you know, or that can be a way to guide decision making, but still remaining within the boundaries of what you know will be helpful, you know. And there's also moments where, I mean, I don't ask their opinion for every single thing, you know. Like there's moments where things need to work, the sessions need to roll. You have 35 young players in a room. We need to make sure things go, you know. And so it's important, but having this communication and providing the chance to have autonomy at given times will also help, that when there's a moment where now it needs to be like this and it has to happen right now, I think people and athletes are more receptive, and they're accepting it, okay, because like they realize in this moment we just need to do it this way, you know. And
Yeah, context is important
yeah,
for
exactly.
sure. Nice. Thank you. For anybody that's still interested, the whole text of Lassie about autonomy, it can be found on his website. Let's continue with your current responsibilities as a coach at Lugano. So planning and delivery of S&C sessions for the roster is obviously a big part of it. Can you guide us through a typical week, like within the season? How do you structure your week? How do you organize a single weight session? How can we picture that?
So in the Swiss National League, we typically play 2 or 3 games per week.
That's a lot.
If we go now considering the in-season part of the year, we will typically play Tuesday, Friday, Saturday. in a week. So Monday we'll have a practice day. Wednesday, in that case, will be a regeneration day for the players who play more. Might be we might have a skills online sessions for guys with lower ice time or younger players. Thursday will be again a practice day. We play Friday, Saturday, Sunday's a day off. So that's like a typical week, let's say, in our league. And this goes from our preseason starts in August. Our regular season starts about mid-September, mm-hmm. goes until March. Then after March, we have playoffs. So then just depends on the success of the team, how long your season is. After the season, you have those three weeks off about. Then you start off-season training for whatever, 8 to 13 weeks. Players then get, and staff get a couple of weeks in July of holidays, and then you go again for a new season. So just to have an idea of the whole year.
Yeah.
And back. So back to the in season. I would say the daily schedule depends maybe a bit on how the coaches want to do their meetings. But we are pretty restricted as far as the ice time is what it is in our arena for us. So we always practice in the morning. We'll always have every practice day. We'll have a warm up and something in the gym before going on the ice, and then depending on when we play, we're gonna have a strength or power session, possibly also after the ice.
So you have 10-15 minutes, I don't know, warm up, mobility, activation type of activity off ice before you get on ice, do your practice, and then there could be potentially a strength session afterwards again in the weight room.
Yeah, the warm up is a bit longer because. I call it warm up, but for me, it's a way of, you know, that's where you put your work in, and that's where you create your workload. That's where you get your injury prevention exercises. That's mobility, everything. And so I would say it's more, we're talking more 30 to 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Of time dedicated to off ice training. Obviously part of that is just, you know, easy cycling, stretching, mobility. We're not talking 40 minutes of intense activity. Then typical practice will be 50 to 60 minutes in season. I mean, depends a bit on coaches, but that's kind of the time that players spend on the ice. And then a strength session after the ice will be anywhere between 15 and 30 minutes. It's very rare that we would go longer than that in
15 season. 15 and 30, okay. So,
yeah, so it can be
in and out, get shit done.
They're warm, they're warm, they come down. Yeah, it depends there if it's just lower body. If you typically, it's gonna be more like you have a lower body and then two upper body exercises.
So you have a primary lower body lift that you hit for a certain number of sets, and then you have a supersetted upper body work, and then you're done. Or how?
Yeah, like
how
a push and pull. Yeah, that's typically that would be like a strength session. You know, it can be, and that's where you're gonna have some differentiation also between players, also based on their testing. So some people will have more focus on lean mass, some on eccentric strength, or whatever we kind of identify as their priorities of development. And that's mm-hmm. where we're gonna have people doing back squats with no AEL, so accentuated eccentric loading with weight releasers. You're going to have people doing super maximal leg press training. Some will be more on like just a trap bar deadlift from the floor, so more like a concentric based. So we adapt that. There's lots of variation in that main lower body strength exercise typically. And then upper body, well, you know, like something like bench press, pull-ups, pretty heavy, three sets typically, you know, is the volume you're gonna have. But then there's lots of difference there as far as are we targeting lean mass or not. That happens more on the upper body in season. And so like in the morning, you know, like I'll be there with the team. I'll do the whole session. Monday mornings we also monitor. We know we do CMJ on force plates. We have the force frame, so like hip adduction, abduction strength. We do these things weekly, Monday morning following a day off. Then as far as my job, typically when the team is done, I might have some gym work with the injured players, or I might go on the ice before the team with an injured player, and then the team might come back after. And it changes really depending on competition schedule. I really believe in, we get strength training when the calendar allows it to. Yep. So anytime there's a spot we can fit in there, we'll have a session. And that's where I like the concept of microdosing. You know, like we know that smaller doses, even split throughout the week, will have less of an impact, both objective and subjective impact of fatigue or soreness. But at the end of the week, if you get that volume, even through five different sessions of, you know, 5 days you do one set, or one day you do five sets, you get those that strength training, that your strength level will
maintain. Yeah,
will maintain, for example. So it's really every time the calendar offers us the chance to train, we'll do it. Players who have lower ice time will train a bit extra after games. When you're injured, we right away take that as an opportunity to work on whatever is healthy and really push that part.
So yeah. It's an open window for stuff that you usually don't have time for.
Exactly. So it's very I would say very random as far as where the opportunities are, but what's consistent is we do our pre-ice work happens every single practice day.
Yeah.
And that's where I really build that. I know we're getting that mobility, that you know, some power exercises, core, whatever it is, I know we're getting them done every single week, every single practice day, and then we lift every time it's possible. Mm. Does that answer your question as far as
that's perfect process? Thank you. Thank you. I'm right on to my next point, which is it's also on your bullet points of your responsibilities. It's a mentoring of academy coaches and SNC interns. So you yourself said when you started as an assistant coach in the under 17, you had somebody that was guiding you, kind of a mentor for you. So I assume you benefit a lot of that. And now you probably want to lay out a certain system for all the other guys that are coming now. So what process is laid out for new S&C coaches starting at the under 17 level, maybe now, or if you have an intern coming up? What do you do to make sure that these people, get an overview of how things are being done at Lugano, and that they fit the overall strategy that you as S&C coaches are trying to follow?
Yeah, I should probably start by saying that in the last few years we've had a lot of changes in who takes care of what responsibility S&C wise, for example, in our youth section. Mm-hmm. And this has been just because we've had people doing it very well, but they've maybe grown up into actually a head coach role, or our current skills coach used to be a very good professional player here, and he was able to also do the off-ice part for some teams. So there's been lots of changes, but this is the reality typically also in these roles is you will often have younger, less experienced coaches come and work for these roles, and then we need to make sure that we help them grow as coaches, but also they're able to then provide the quality of training that we want for our players.
Yeah.
So there's been such different situations, I would say in this case, I can answer to you as far as this is the exact process I have for when a coach comes in. It's been more, okay, here's the coach we have this year. Where are we with him? What are the needs that what do we need this person to be good at to help us from today? If we want that next year, this coach has more responsibility, where do we need to help him grow? And then it's me being available, me being, you know, maybe first presenting a bit first, obviously, how we train, what I believe in, sharing, you know, obviously my programs, the things that I do, and then discussing that with them. Spending time in the gym with them for even technical work, And then again, you might have a person come from personal training who's actually very good at the technical part of lifts because they're used to be coaching people who lift. Or you might have a person come from sports science world that have a very large theoretical base, but have a bit less experience in the gym. So it's been more, in our case, guiding the person based on their strengths and weaknesses as far as the process.
Perfect. Thank you.
But yeah, like you said, I see life as a growing process for myself, and I want that to be also for the people who come in here. I've had my chance when I was early in my career. Lots of good coaches grow from just having the opportunity. So it's really about helping them grow, try to support them in the motivation to grow and give them the chances to then take responsibility and see where they can go. You know, some of the people that I have done, for example, internships here are now in different teams in our league or taking some other responsibility, coaching roles with the Swiss Olympic system. So that's great to see that they grow into these positions. Yeah,
that's amazing, and I really like the approach to be part of something bigger in terms of, you know, helping them grow as a coach, becoming the best practitioner that they can become for themselves, and being part of that. I like that. Lassie, thank you. We're almost at the end. Before we come to the finish, we should exchange our personal questions. Would you like to start?
You'll start, then I'll go with my
answer. Okay, I'll start then. How do you imagine your pension? Like, you know, when you're done with your 40, 45 years of working at the Hockey Club Lugano and it's time to settle down, how do you picture that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I spend so much time thinking so far ahead at all. I picture it hopefully just following what my happy kids, then who will then be adults, do in their lives. Mm-hmm. We have a chance to have a beautiful cottage on an island in Finland.
Okay.
So I really wouldn't mind spending my summers there. That's nice. My introvert part that really looks forward to spending 3 months on an island. But yeah, that's nice. That's something that I really could imagine me and my wife spend some time there. And, you know, I'm very lucky because for a long time when I was playing, I felt like, or after playing, like you're chasing the next opportunity, you're chasing the next thing. And I realized even in SNC, people move a lot around for their jobs. And I know, you know, you never know when it's your turn, but Lugano is my home and we feel really good here. So I'm in a position where I'm already now basically really enjoying my current life, and this means that I don't feel the need to
chase the next.
Exactly. I'm very happy. I'm very driven as a person. I'm very happy where I am, and I just take it more as of, you know, I'm happy to live it today, and we'll see what life brings. I think the last few years have shown us that there's so much unpredictability. In this world that, you know, things can just change all of a sudden, and then you just adapt, and if that will be the case, we'll do it. But yeah, that summers in Finland will probably be a part of that of that pension. Yeah,
thank you for sharing, but I really like the attitude, and I'm so happy for you that you have reached that level where you say, hey, this is great stuff, I'm enjoying every day, and trying to make the best out of it.
Yeah.
Question answered. Thanks. You go ahead now.
So for you, you know, like when we met in St. Mary's, I always liked the fact that sometimes your background or your passions were a bit different than what the traditional SNC coach might be or might be seen at. And so you always had that sometimes different point of view on things. And I was always found that very interesting when talking with you. So what brings you satisfaction? You know, like you're doing now coaching, you're doing personal training. What is or what will success be for you?
Nice question. Meaningful change is part of my training philosophy. And I actually learned these words from Dan, our program director. Like, what does meaningful change mean? And it's super dependent on the individual and the context. So in the athletic environment, meaningful change can just be for an athlete to, I don't know, get stronger or stay injury free or whatever. In the personal training, which is, you know, at this moment, where I'm spending the most time, it can be that someone loses their fear of movement, or it can be that somebody is regaining trust in their knee again so they can squat down and play with their grandchildren. So it might be something totally trivial for somebody else, for you and me maybe, but for them it just changes the whole world because they can play with the children on the ground. Today, this morning, I had a session with a client who is absolutely frightened doing things upside down. I had a session with her 2 years back now, where she just needed to hang from a bar with her hip on top of the bar, but then hanging legs down and head down. And she was shaking like crazy, holding my hands, telling me, stay with me, I'm afraid. And today she did her first handstand, and she came out of it and she was just screaming, like, yes. And she's 40, I think 44 years old. So she's still like learning new things. And yeah, that shit creates meaningful change for her. She's like broadening her perspective and is just getting hungry for more stuff. So if I can see that change in people, and it doesn't matter at what level, professional, general population or couch potato, I don't care. But if I can ignite this, then this is something that really drives me. That makes me happy.
Nice, yeah. I can see that. Yeah, like knowing you, I you know, these words for sure sound very true to what I know of you.
Thanks, man. That's a great question. And thank you for your time, Lassie. We've come to the end of the podcast. Before we finish up, any last words from you, something you want to get out there to our listeners, please tell them. You can also tell them where they can find you if they want to find you. I'll definitely make sure that the link to your website is in the show notes of this episode. And last words are for you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for just having me on this podcast. Just enjoyed the conversation with you. Like I said, it's always enjoyed exchanging ideas with you. And today was the same. Sometimes you just focus on things that people don't think of so much. And this is also something that I like to have in my practice, that sometimes we overlook things that have a big impact in coaching or for sports. So just, I put some of those words into these articles that we did, that I did for the website. So if people want to read there, I have social media. I'm not very active lately at all, to be honest, but if people reach out, I'm always happy to answer. And so, yeah, just have my contact there. And thank you for your time today.
Perfect. I'll make sure to put your Instagram account also into the show notes. Thank you to listeners for making it all the way to the end, and hear you again in 2 weeks. Until then, train smart and move well.